This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a podcast from BBC Radio 4. Normally you might expect to find the briefing room here, but this week, as we're just about to start what could be another highly eventful year, we thought you might like to listen to a programme we put together with senior BBC correspondents, forecasting what might happen in the news over the year ahead.
Welcome to the Correspondents' Look Ahead. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, there's a widespread feeling among pundits and mere observers too that really nobody knows anything anymore. Many defend the record of experts, but many deride them as ill-informed and worse, biased as well, concealing self-interested agendas. This year's largely unpredicted events included a political novice shattering France's two-party system and the British Prime Minister calling a snap election, only to see a double-digit poll lead dissipate into no overall majority in Parliament. And then Robert Mugabe resigned. Who predicted that? So, it's either a time to junk expertise or to prize it ever more highly. And I'm joined this year by five people who've agreed to take a look ahead to 2018. We've got Carrie Gracie, BBC's China editor, Kevin Connolly, Europe correspondent, Yolan Nell, Middle East correspondent, James Robbins, our diplomatic correspondent, and James Naughtie, our special correspondent. So between you all, you'll be able to cover just about everywhere, I think. And we're going to start with the United States and Donald Trump. And we've all followed the last year of Donald Trump. Jim, what's ahead for Donald Trump in 2018?
Well, I think we've got to start with the fact that some people forget, Owen, which is this, that his rating at the end of 1 year in office is lower than the rating on equivalent poll findings since the 50s than any other president in our lifetimes. I mean, a CNN poll in December, which is following on the whole Gallup ORC thing over the years, same question, same timing, had him at 35%. Obama at the same time was at 75%. Now, this is extraordinary. It doesn't mean that he can't excite that base, and he does every day on Twitter and with these regular rallies. But the truth is, he is fantastically unpopular among Americans. If you were a Republican member of Congress in a what the Americans would call an upscale district, a reasonably affluent district, let's say in California, where there are five Republicans very worried about their seats now, if you look at what's happened to women voters vis-a-vis Trump, they're deserting him like snow off a dike. I speak from a very frosty Edinburgh.
OK, well,
and I think yep. that, you know, we all say that, this can't go on. He does things that no one else has done. But he does it. I mean, my feeling about Trump is that at some point, I suspect, and this is my prediction on Trump, Owen, that somebody somewhere in the administration, either in the White House or very close to it, will break cover this year and tell us what the chaos in the White House, which it's generally accepted to be, has been like. And I think that will be devastating for Donald Trump. Of course, there's a section of the American public which simply won't believe it. But
yeah,
I think it will be out there.
That 35% may well stay loyal. But, let me just ask everyone then, and this is my first attempt to get predictions from you, because there are midterm elections coming up, and many people think that the Senate will stay as it is. But will the House of Representatives go to the Democrats? There are people predicting it will. There are people predicting it won't. So, first of all, I'll go through you all. James Robbins, Will the Democrats take the House?
Yes, I think they will. But I think the larger point, listening to Jim, is that we've got to keep hold of the fact that Donald Trump will remain commander-in-chief of America's armed forces. He'll remain the president. I'm not predicting impeachment or resignation. And that will have a continuing profound effect on all of us throughout the rest of the world. In 2017, we've seen him progressively declare some sort of warfare on most of the international institutions, ending the year with this fairly severe cut to the funding of the United Nations in 2018. And at the same time, of course, this commander-in-chief is presiding over numerous global crises, including the extraordinary crisis with North Korea. And my prediction is, if you like, a sort of Trump prediction, but it's for South Korea. I'm predicting, as a consequence of this collision between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, that there'll be a mass evacuation of the Korean capital, Seoul, not just an exercise, but actually a mass evacuation in fear of a possible exchange of weapons, conventional or otherwise, between the United States and North Korea. I don't think that exchange will actually take place, but I think what have been exercises involving American expatriates, British expatriates, and the people of Korea, I think there will be a mass evacuation because things will get so tense.
Right, gosh.
This will be Cuba, Cuba plus, plus, plus.
OK, well, we will maybe talk a bit more about North Korea later. Let's just go stick with the House of Representatives. And Carrie and Yolande, is not really your territory, but are you're obviously following it. What are you expecting?
So what I'd say, this is Carrie, China editor, is that from where we sit in Beijing, it doesn't entirely matter, because the more important Trump story is whether he addresses what he promised his voters he would do, which is to take on China over unequal trade. And the ceasefire that we saw on that issue throughout 2017 because of the North Korea issue, because Trump took the view that he needed to give China a window of opportunity to deal with North Korea and he would give it a pass on trade while doing that, that that ceasefire will be over, and that soon into 2018 we'll see the investigations into steel dumping alleged and intellectual property theft alleged. We'll see those investigations come back and Donald Trump will announce a series of robust measures to try to deal with the enormous trade deficits that the United States suffers in relation to China.
Yolande?
Well, I'm going to predict a Democrat win in the House of Representatives, but from where I'm sitting in Jerusalem, it's Trump's pronouncement at the beginning of December where he decided that he was going to move the U.S. embassy here from Tel Aviv, that he's going to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That's still, of course, the big topic of conversation. Mr. Trump delighted Israel, much of his pro-Israel evangelical base, some quarters of the U.S. Jewish community who supported him. There's been fury on the Palestinian side, a lot of unrest around the Middle East. But my Trump prediction for 2018 concerns his Middle East peace plan. Although the Palestinians have already come out saying that they're going to reject that, White House officials have accepted that there has to be what they've called a kind of cooling off period. I think it's unlikely to bring peace, but I do think there is going to be this peace plan produced early in 2018. Mr. Trump's had his son-in-law and close aides working on it for the best part of a year. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the Palestinians, given the US role as a major donor to the Palestinian Authority, that there are other Arab states likely to bring pressure to bear as we see alliances shifting around this region. The Palestinians say the US isn't an honest mediator, and we could see other players getting involved. Japan and China have even been mentioned in the last few days, but the US is going to continue to take a lead.
Now then, Kevin Connolly, the House of Representatives, I'm going to try and get you all to make your predictions on this. What are you expecting?
Well, does it sound shallow to start off by saying that our business owes Donald Trump, I think, quite a debt of gratitude? Everybody knows that, you know, if you want your headline to be clicked on any internet news service, you put the name Trump in the headline. I see he's now being credited with a revival in paid-for subscriptions to American newspapers online as well. So, you know, he is extraordinary box office, which I guess is why you can canvass opinion from all over the world about the likely results in the House election. I would say, as things stand, it's likelier than not that the Democrats will win a majority. But I think there are two separate sets of numbers which weigh in on the future of Donald Trump. One is the numbers in the American economy, which look okay and which might start to look better. We will see if that generates a revival, if in the end Americans care about their pocketbook more than they care about the other stuff that makes the headlines about their president. The other thing, though, is those popularity ratings that Jim started off talking about. I mean, I wonder how we all judge Trump's personality. It seems to me here is a man who can't really metabolize the concept of defeat. And I wonder if he's looking at terrible numbers when it comes time for him to decide whether or not to run again, that he might simply be tempted to say, look, I have achieved the transformation in American society that I was sent to bring, and I stepped down after a single term. So he is a figure of eternal fascination, I suppose, for all sorts of reasons, for not using the language that other politicians have always used. But as I say, I think those two conflicting issues of popularity and economic performance are going to decide his future and other future American elections.
Kevin, from Jim in Edinburgh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I would add one rider to that, and I think the tax bill passed in the last few days is going to prove spectacularly unpopular with the voters who will decide whether the House stays Republican or Democrat. And I think that might be the thing that swings it the other way. But look, let's talk about the elephant in the room who is advancing in the White House with cat-like tread, namely Robert Mueller, ex-head of the FBI. Don't forget that his chief prosecutor, Mr. Weissman, who's working beside him, is the man who dismantled the Brooklyn Mafia in the 1980s and brought down Enron. And he is the man advancing on the White House very, very determinedly. And I think that if Donald J. Trump Jr. or Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, whom Yolande mentioned with respect to the Middle East, were to be in the frame, even indicted, we don't know, I think from Trump's point of view, that would be an absolute... It would be a personal crisis of huge dimensions. And would, towards the end of his term, would he want to go on if that is the way it is proceeding? And there are plenty of people on Capitol Hill who believe that that's where it will end up.
I'm now going to, since you've all started making predictions, and it's a slightly unfair, because some of you weren't here last year, but for those who were, it's only, I suppose, right and proper that I point out, James, that you, James Robbins, thought he wouldn't walk away from the Paris Climate Treaty. That was wrong. And first trip to Canada. Kevin, you thought his first trip would be to Canada. His first trip was to Saudi. So there is a sort of... I have to say, I thought that Rubio would be in the White House by now. You know, we have to put those points in, that this prediction game isn't quite as easy as it seems.
I don't imagine... I never visualise anybody rushing off to the bookmakers after this programme goes off the air.
So very wise
I'm going to relatively relaxed about it. I can remember several other things that I personally got wrong in last year's programme off the top of my head.
François Fillon was going to be president of France.
François Fillon was going to be president, and may well have been if it weren't for the entirely unforeseeable circumstances that eventually engulfed him, of course.
OK, so top predictions, very quickly, rapid fire. Top predictions for 2018. We'll be doing People to Watch and some wildcard predictions later. Carrie Gracie, your top prediction.
I think we will see negotiations on the Korean Peninsula. We'll see China, the United States, South Korea and North Korea sit down. And the upshot of that will be a deal whereby North Korea agrees to freeze its nuclear and missile programs in exchange for the US and South Korea dialing back their military exercises on the peninsula.
Kevin Connolly.
I am going to predict that, it's not going to sound terribly spectacular, but I'm going to predict that Brexit is going to rumble along a bit less disastrously than you might think. That's not to say the British politics domestically surrounding it won't be very difficult, but I think the actual negotiated process here might just about rumble along okay, because there are two big teams of very experienced professionals doing it, and they have got it over the first hurdle, if you like, and I think that shows you that they can get the job done. I mean, mind you, it took the UK 11 years to negotiate its way into the European Union, so God knows how long it's going to take in the end to negotiate a way back out again. But non-disastrous rumbling of Brexit is my big prediction.
Yolande Nell.
Well, I learned from the predictions that were made last year, which included the Iran nuclear deal, I guess to take President Trump at his word when it comes to promises that he made on the campaign trail. Also, you can see he's very motivated by hostility towards the Obama administration. You see this in his dealings with Iran. So I'm going to predict that he's going to reimpose US sanctions on Iran, particularly targeting the elite military wing, the Revolutionary Guard. He's got to decide what he wants to do, if he wants to continue to waive energy sanctions coming up in just the next few weeks. And his national security strategy speech made very clear that the threat that he continues to see from Iran. But I'm also going to predict that the nuclear deal will live on despite those US threats. Because, of course, you've got the other five powers, the UK, France, Germany, Russia and China, that were signatories as well as Iran.
James Robbins?
I agree with Kevin. I think that there will be a non-disastrous rumbling on of the Brexit talks. But I think the government will suffer at least one substantial House of Commons defeat during 2018, led by Remainers, rebels, mutineers, call them what you will, trying to impose a softer Brexit. I think the government will lose that vote, but will then narrowly squeak through a confidence motion and will avoid a general election. But I think it's going to be pretty painful for all sides.
I think picking up on that, and I want to say that I agree with Kevin about Brexit, and I think that that will keep that strange stasis in British politics, where the Conservative Party is riven by divisions over Brexit, so is the Labour Party. But if it rumbles on, despite the defeat, which I think James is right in suggesting will come on some aspects, it will probably still be there. And the idea a year from now that Theresa May is facing imminent defeat, which was the case 3 months ago, according to many of her MPs, will be gone for the moment.
What about the Lords? And will the House of Lords inflict defeats on the government? And will they matter?
I think the Lords will try to frame amendments that exploit the fissures in both the big parties in the Commons. But I suspect that given that there's a majority in the Commons, as we know, a secret majority for membership of the single market and the customs union, that can't show its face and dare not speak its name, the Lords will try to exploit that, and in one or two moments they'll succeed. Now, I don't think the outcome will be that Britain will stay in the single market or the customs union, but it will send a very, very strong signal.
Kevin Connolly on the Lords, and also just on whether the European negotiators you're talking to believe now that Theresa May will be their interlocutor for the whole of the process.
Well, I think the interesting thing about their relationship with Theresa May is you could see when it looked as though this was going to go wrong early in December and that the test of sufficient progress was not going to be passed. People like Jean-Claude Juncker suddenly came out praising Theresa May's negotiating abilities, praising her diplomatic skills, her political leadership, her toughness, her ability to represent her country. They are terrified that Theresa May's government is going to collapse because, of course, of the whole way that the Article 50 negotiations are structured. The problem is that, as things stand, the United Kingdom ceases to be a member of the European Union, period, on March the 29th, 2019. And if, as a result of political manoeuvrings at Westminster, a deal is not completed or not accepted or is still being tinkered with, then Britain will leave without a deal. So that iron timetable is that clock which has been started and which is ticking down inexorably. So, you know, when we talk about these kind of delays at home, how the politics of the Conservative Party might hold things up, how Labour's problems might also be a problem, all of the time that clock is running. Unless Britain goes to the European Union at some point, probably in the coming year, and asks for the timetable to be changed. Now, it can be changed, but it's not going to be easy to persuade them to do that. So that's a huge difficulty that Theresa May is working against. That's why the Europeans are so worried about her.
Thank you very much. Let's have some comments on Russia. And I'm just going to start this by asking if there is anyone amongst you who thinks that Putin will not win his elections in the spring?
No.
Silence?
No. Yeah. Silence.
So it's President Putin, and let me ask you the more difficult question. How's Russia going to handle the World Cup? Kevin?
I think Russia will handle the World Cup much better than outsiders might imagine. You've all seen some of the mad preparations. You look at the stadium in Yekaterinburg, which they expanded by basically building a new stand outside the stadium. So you're sitting miles away from the pitch, looking in through the stadium wall at it. There's always going to be a little eccentricity about Russian arrangements. But think back to the Moscow Olympics of 1980, you know, when the Soviet Union was in economic trouble, had enormous problems in Afghanistan, had enormous problems with the global boycott of their Olympic Games, and still managed an event to be proud of. They know how to do things. They know how to get things done on a big scale. And, look, I lived in Russia for 5 years. I travelled to most of the cities where the Games are going to be held. I think, however charmless the Russian authorities can look on the international stage, people will be amazed by the warmth and openness of the Russian people. And I would be very surprised if it's not a good World Cup. The Russians have security problems, of course, based in the Caucasus and based on their own problems with Islamist movements there. So there's going to be plenty of the usual, I suppose, now inevitable tension around security issues at big sporting events. But I think this is one of the things that Russia knows how to do. And it's not really a prediction, but I would bet that they will get it right, even if they've robbed themselves of the chance to have the footballing aristocrats of Northern Ireland amongst the teams playing in the final.
And the other footballing aristocrats, the Chinese, won't be there, much to Xi Jinping's disappointment and the disappointment of many football fans in China. But interestingly, the last time I looked, the Chinese were buying more hotel rooms during the World Cup in Moscow and other cities than anywhere else. So perhaps some will be grateful that China's national team didn't qualify, because otherwise there would be no room for anyone else. I think in the absence of a Chinese team, they'll be supporting Germany, though, for strength, discipline and teamwork.
And Yolande, from your region, the point is that Egypt is there for, what, the first time since 1990?
That's right, since Italy 1990, so it's a 28-year absence. They're actually through to the World Cup finals with Saudi Arabia, who will play the opening match against Russia. Then you've got Morocco and Tunisia. Actually, Iran from my region is through as well. It's the first time you've had so many Arab countries in the mix, but I think my favourite are going to be the Pharaohs, not least because I used to live in Egypt, and they're looking much more organised and disciplined than they have for years. And I think really their man to watch is Mohamed Salah, the Liverpool forward. He's become Egypt's national hero after he scored 2 goals in the match against Congo that took Egypt through to the finals. It was 1-1, then he got his second goal in stoppage time. It was the 95th minute. The country went crazy when the ball went into the net. President Sisi singled him out for thanks afterwards. You had fans on social media, instead of saying Sabah al-Khair, good morning in Arabic, they were saying Salah al-Khair. His school was renamed after him, and tour agencies began offering special discounts to anyone who was called Mo Salah, including the honeymoon packages, I should say. So I think I'm wishing good luck to Mohamed Salah and anyone called Mohamed Salah in the World Cup.
Do any of you claim the sufficient expertise to tell us who's going to win?
No, except I can tell you, Owen, that a still small voice from Edinburgh joins Carrie and Kevin in saying that Scotland isn't there, and that is huge national relief, because the ritual humiliation that occurs when Scotland do get through to World Cup finals is not going to occur. But I couldn't agree more with Kevin that I think Putin, who clearly will spend what it takes to make this work, will turn it into a fest which people around the world will be invited to admire.
James Robbins, can I be a dissident? I don't agree with Kevin and that endorsement by Jim Nocte. I don't think this will be quite the triumph that President Putin is hoping for two particular reasons. I think he will have trouble controlling his own far right among young people. I think there will be some appalling displays of racism and homophobia. I think there'll probably be violence at some of the grounds. And I think the other thing that the Russians haven't quite faced up to is that they are going to be the spotlight of an unparalleled number of journalists scattered across the whole of Russia. I saw the largest number of journalists who visited Russia since 1917, and I think Russia is going to come out of that scrutiny badly. A lot of people will get visas to cover the games and will probably do a lot of other things that the Russians wish they wouldn't in scrutinising Russian society.
Let's take a closer look at the Middle East now, and I just wanted to ask you all about where Iraq and Syria are going. The Islamic State group seems to be scattered to the winds. Do any of you think that will change in 2018, that there will be a reconstitution of the Islamic State group, or maybe another group like it called something different?
I think there's every chance there'll be another group like it but called something different, because I think there is a cadre within Arab societies in the Middle East which espouses that view of violence, which espouses that interpretation of Islam, and which can easily remodel itself into a similar but different sounding group perhaps somewhere else. I mean, I think, you know, you are defeating its current physical military formation on the ground, but you're not defeating the idea. You're not winning a battle of ideas within Islam, however small that minority might be. And I think we had the same conversation, depressingly, at the same point in the same programme last year, which is to say the issue facing Syria is whether it can be resurrected as a unitary state after all this appalling destruction, and whether Iraq can emerge from all of this as a functioning society with a central government. So I think, you know, in a sense, nothing has moved in the last year, although things have changed on the battlefields, of course.
Ilan, let me bring you in on this, because the Iraqi government is saying it's won now, and I guess the Syrians are very close to saying something similar. Do you think those two governments, Baghdad and Damascus, will reemerge as effective capitals?
Certainly, as far as Syria is concerned, I don't see that happening in the near future. And Russia has been very involved here as well, of course, where it's had a lot of military success. It saved President Bashar al-Assad. And the challenge in 2018 is to convert that into some sort of political settlement. And that, if you like, is the real test to President Putin's aim of projecting Russian power. It's forged an alliance with Iran and Turkey to try to take the lead diplomatically. They want to have a peace summit in Sochi in January that's supposed to frame a new constitution to be followed by elections. But I have to predict Russia's going to fail in its attempt to bring lasting peace to Syria with President Assad in control, because he's not able to bring opposition forces along. You've got already many of the rebel factions operating in Syria putting out a joint statement saying that they're rejecting the conference. They only want to sit down for talks when President Assad is held accountable for human rights abuses, including, of course, what UN investigators say was the use of chemical weapons. And without regime change, it's also going to be very hard to persuade millions of refugees to return to get Western reconstruction aid for the destroyed cities in Syria. And then, of course, you've got this alliance between Russia and Iran coming under strain too. They've got very different visions and interests, where Russia's already withdrawn warplanes. It wants to keep its two military bases in Syria, but it's happy to pull back. Iran and its Revolutionary Guard don't want to pull back their presence or see their influence diluted. So I do predict continuing instability, turmoil in Syria. And I think when it comes to Islamic State, so-called, we shouldn't write them off with their territorial losses. And if you look at IS communications, they continue actually to talk about Syria. It's still very important for the group. It's got this strong religious symbolism, associations with apocalyptic prophecies. In their literature, they continue to talk about eastern Syria in particular, and I think they will carry on trying to target parts of Iraq, which is, of course, going towards parliamentary elections in 2018. They're due in May, the elections. Also, the Egyptian Sinai, and Egypt too is expected to have presidential elections in the first half of 2018. I'm sure that these elections are going to become targets for jihadists, but I also think that security concerns are going to help keep both Haider al-Abadi and President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in power as well.
Do you think that, as some people predict, that it's likely to be a change in leadership in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, over the next year or 18 months?
We've got very much used to having the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. He's serving his fourth term in office, but police have long been investigating him for bribery and for fraud. He denies any wrongdoing, but if charges are brought against him, he could be forced to stand down to defend himself, and then Israel could face general elections. And actually, if we go on to names to watch for 2018, then my name to watch is the opposition leader Yair Lapid, because, you know, he's a former journalist and news anchor, known as a moderate. He's head of a centrist party, the Yesh Atid. There is a future party. And I think that he could end up being asked, if parliamentary elections are held, to lead the next coalition government. I mean, Israeli politics is notoriously unpredictable, so it's risky venturing into this game. But, you know, he is somebody to watch out for. He is someone who grew up in Tel Aviv and London. He has a black belt in karate, so, you know, quite an interesting character.
I hope we all have enough humility to worry about the fate of a country that would fall into the hands of a leader who used to be a broadcaster.
So that's her person to watch. Yes, well, she has previewed our people to watch with Yair Lapid. And I'm going to ask the rest of you to give us your names. Carrie Gracie, who will you be watching in 2018?
I'm going to go for two 30-year-old women. One is Crystal Liu, who is going to star in the live-action Disney remake of Mulan, and she speaks perfect English, and she is a great dancer. She's going to have to turn those skills to martial arts because the story is about a daughter who disguises herself as a man to take her father's place as a conscript in a Chinese war and goes on to save China. So she's one of my people to watch. And the other one is another Liu, in fact, Liu Wen, who is China's first, or known as China's first, supermodel. She's going to be 30 in 2018, and she's going to grace the front cover of Elle, which is also turning 30. Now, she comes from a pig farming town in Hunan province, which is Chairman Mao's home province, and is known more for its chili peppers than it is for fashion. And I suppose her rise, Liu Wen's rise from daughter of construction worker to global supermodel mirrors that of China over the past 30 years.
Two faces of China, thank you. Kevin Connolly, your person to watch in 2018.
Well, I was going to say Silvio Berlusconi, who might be on the point of making a comeback in the Italian elections in the early part of the year. He always reminds me of that thing that Bob Hope said about Ronald Reagan, vote for Ronnie because his hair can't stay this colour forever. There's Berlusconi still with his jet black hair, really quite seriously possibly making a comeback. But instead, I'm going to take us back to the football. My person to watch is going to be Neymar, the star of the Brazilian team, because of what he represents in global football. He's been bought by Paris Saint-Germain. That is a team, of course, owned in effect by a nation state, Qatar. So they've completely changed the financial dynamics, even of modern football. They paid Barcelona, in effect, about $250 million for Neymar. They pay him $40 million a year. The Football World Cup in Russia is his chance to step up to that pantheon where you have Pelé and Maradona and Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi. Is he good enough to do that? Will he be the person whose performances at this World Cup are remembered perhaps after everything else we're talking about in this programme will be forgotten, as you had with Pelé at the World Cup in 1958 in Sweden? So Neymar, a huge amount of pressure and expectation on his shoulders, a huge amount of money has gone into him, and, you know, in the most literal sense, of course, when the Football World Cup starts, in spite of James's gloomy prognostications, the world will be watching him.
James Robbins, person to watch.
Cyril Ramaphosa, because he has achieved against overwhelming odds the leadership of the African National Congress and is therefore set on course, I think, to be the next president of South Africa from 2019. It matters because this is a man, I should declare an interest, who I've known on and off since the mid-1980s when he was a young radical leader of the Mine Workers Union in apartheid South Africa and did as much as almost anybody to help bring down apartheid by his use of industrial muscle from within. It matters because he was much despised by the ANC in exile and they've managed to prevent him reaching the summit until now, control of the ANC, and he's seen off, of course, a man widely regarded as deeply corrupt, although he entirely denies it, Jacob Zuma, and he promises a completely new post-Mandela South Africa. He's got a huge amount to do. Will he be able to bear down on corruption in his early period in office before he becomes president of the country, or will he find that the corrupt are simply trying to commit larceny on an even grander scale before he gets control of the nation? Nevertheless, he's shown resolve. He's a real person to watch. In the non-political arena, I want a shout-out for Boyan Slat, who will be 24 next year, and he's the man, the young man who believes that it is possible to clean up the oceans and rid them of plastics. He's got a very ambitious scheme for trying to corral the plastics in the Pacific. It's not at all proven that it will work, but sea trials start in earnest in 2018. I think we should watch that. And my shout-out in sport is for the Nigerian women's bobsleigh team, who have a very real chance of getting to Korea. The qualification process isn't over yet. I think they'll be in Seoul. It's an extraordinary, remarkable story. They say so themselves. I mean, who of us, they say, could ever imagine coming from Nigeria, sliding down ice at 80 or 90 miles per hour?
We may well be
about to do it.
You follow the bobsleigh, the women's bobsleigh.
I follow all bobsleigh. I think it's... I'm an events sports watcher. I only watch events at World Cup and Olympic level. Despair of most sports broadcasters, but I think this is a really exciting development.
Okay, that's the Winter Olympics. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Jim Nocte, your
person. You've stolen my line, James. I was going to talk about the Nigerian bobsleigh team, women's bobsleigh team.
Now's your chance.
I've got one name to chuck in. Bizarre though it may seem, I think by the end of this year, we will discover that against all the odds, really, at the age of 75, Joe Biden really is running for President of the United States. Now, I don't think he'll get there in the end, but he may be one of the agents that pulls that party together. But I think all the signs are that he is really serious about it. Now, that would mean that at the time of the next presidential election, I'm not sure exactly when his birthday falls, but he would be either 77 or 78. Quite extraordinary. I mean, Reagan was only 70 or thereabouts when he was elected. But I suppose everybody's getting older, like all of us, and especially in the United States. But he's going for it. It's quite remarkable.
Yolan Nell, your person of the year.
My person of the year is Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think he's definitely a man to watch in 2018. He was probably the Middle East man of 2017. He's got his social reforms in Saudi Arabia, allowing women to drive, allowing cinemas to open. They're due to come online in the months ahead. He's been popular so far with many young Saudis because they'd like their country to open up socially and economically. They know that its over-reliance on oil revenue has to end. But of course, there's a real danger that he could overreach himself and that there'll be some kind of backlash from religious clerics, considering some of the moves he's making. Also because of his crackdown on corruption, which is involved, as we know, rounding up princes who are also his cousins and others in the powerful business elite, keeping them in the luxury prison of the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. They've been slowly making deals to get themselves released, but he really does have a lot of enemies. And I think he's also going to see his popularity with young Saudis drop because he and his father are trying to pass austerity measures. But at the same time, there are these reports that come out about his own purchases, which are worth multi-million dollars, a French chateau with all these high-tech innovations, a yacht, a Da Vinci painting. And he's also showing no desire for democratic reform. So when I've spoken to young Saudi activists online who very sensibly remain anonymous, they really don't buy MBS's strategy to end corruption. And there's a lack of enthusiasm, too, for his adventurism when it comes to the rest of the region, particularly what we've seen when it's come to Yemen, where, you know, he went into a war in Yemen as defence minister back in 2015 when he was just the deputy crown prince as well. The UAE lent their support for that. He said he won't pull out until there's a clear victory, and there's no sign of that happening. Also, as he tried to isolate Qatar with other Sunni Arab countries, it's hard to know what he'll get involved with next. I mean, maybe I'm anticipating some squeezing of Jordan and of the Palestinians, particularly when it comes to accepting the terms of a Trump peace plan.
Kevin Connolly, you worked in the Middle East for many years. What do you make of Mohammed bin Salman?
I think he's a gambler in the most conservative society in the world. And I think, you know, he is unleashing hugely unpredictable forces. Things like, you know, as Yolan said, the lifting of the ban on women driving, the opening of cinemas. Nobody knows how that is being interpreted by the religious authorities in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, we forget, is governed by this very, very uneasy dispensation between the royal family on the one hand and the religious authorities on the other. And everybody knows that were the House of Saud ever to fall, it would fall rather in the way that the Shah of Iran did, not swept away by rival royal house or by rival political pretenders to power. It would be swept away by the religious authorities. So he is certainly, I think, a man to watch in 2018. And, you know, he is making enormously big judgments in foreign policy and at home. And it's not at all clear what his basis really is for making those big changes or how much support he will command if push comes to shove.
I'll perhaps just mention one name of my own for 2018. It seems to me quite possible. It's still an open question, but Imran Khan, the cricketer, the former cricketer in Pakistan, could well become Prime Minister in 2018. He's got an increasing base, still small, but nonetheless he does have an electoral base, and he has the army with him, which always helps in Pakistani politics. So he may just see his way to the Prime Minister's office. It's his last chance. He's much older than it seems. He's around 70 now, I think, and he very much wants it. James Robbins, another part of the world for you entirely. Zimbabwe, big things happened in 2017. Mugabe is out. What are you expecting in 2018?
I think it's a real test for Emmerson Mnangagwa as the new president of Zimbabwe. Can he throw off much of his own reputation as a bit of a fixer on behalf of President Mugabe in the past? Can he embrace the young people of Zimbabwe? I think 60% of the population of Zimbabwe is under the age of 24, and we've talked about that new word coined in the Oxford Dictionary, youthquake. I mean, there's a real youthquake going on in Zimbabwe. Can he adapt his own natural conservative politics to embrace a generation who believe that they made the change in 2017 and they're going to demand decisive change in 2018? In other words, will he be able to both revive the broken agricultural system of Zimbabwe, encourage some young people to stay on the land? They fled to the cities, even though there's no work there. Will he be able to revive a very vibrant, creative society that's been horribly damaged? And I think there are high hopes invested in him, and he now has a chance to prove that he can do that.
Now, I think it's only fair to say you've all been admirably forthright, really, this year in your predictions. I mean, when we're getting down to the Winter Olympics, women's bobsleigh races and things like that, with very clear predictions, I really wonder whether there's a need for our next final section. But we'll do it nonetheless, which is wild card predictions and what you just think might, you know, throwing your caution to the winds, what you think might be coming up next year. Jim Naughtie.
Well, I remember James Robbins saying, I think, 2 or 3 years ago on this very programme, that some kind of internet collapse, some sort of horror on the web, was bound to come. Now, we all remember the business at the millennium, that everything was going to go wrong and the world was going to collapse, and it didn't. I feel very strongly that the strangeness of the world in which we've all entered, unwittingly, because we have to, is one that we haven't quite comprehended yet. And if you look at the political consequences of things like WikiLeaks and so on, and the various hacking episodes, which have happened, you know, right across the globe, you've got to believe that at some point there will be something which is cataclysmic, which, if you like, will be a cyber 9/11. It won't necessarily be a hostile attack from one country to another, although it may well be. I think it could be some kind of collapse. And I feel more and more strongly that as we kind of sleepwalk our way into this world, we're going to face a moment like that. And why not say it could be next year?
Thank you. Yolande Nell.
I'm going to predict a resurgence for Al-Qaeda, which has really been trying to rebrand itself very actively online, showcasing previous attacks, widening its network among Salafist jihadist rings. And to point out Osama bin Laden's son, Hamza bin Laden, he's now aspiring to continue his father's legacy. He's considered to be sort of the rising star of Al-Qaeda. And over the past year, we've heard from him increasingly in its propaganda. He's called for attacks on Western targets, put out his advice for martyrdom seekers earlier this year. I think we can expect to hear a lot more from him in the months and the next year.
Yes, they call him the Prince of Jihad. And one of the remarkable things about him is he was in the house that bin Laden was killed in the day before. It's the first time he'd ever visited it. And the day before, it's always struck me as odd there wasn't more comment on that. He visited for a few hours and left. Whether he inadvertently brought some tracker with him or something, who knows? But it's a strange thing. Carrie Gracie.
I'm going to make a prediction for religious communities in China that either the Dalai Lama, now in his 80s, or the Pope are going to make a visit to China. Now, that's obviously quite a long shot and it is a wild card. But I think that obviously Catholics in China and Tibetan Buddhists in China would enormously welcome either of those visits. But just to add a touch of pessimism about that from their point of view, that those religious leaders would be acting from a position of weakness rather than strength, because they would be acknowledging that they would have to make concessions in protecting those communities because of the enormous strength of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, but that if they want to see those believers in their lifetime, they're going to have to get on with it.
Kevin Connolly.
For the European Union, trouble from the East in the person of Prime Minister Kaczynski in Poland and Orbán in Hungary. They do not like taking orders, as they see it, from Europe. They are prepared to make a stand on issues like the resettlement of immigrants, the appointment of judges, control of the media, all those kind of things. They are a huge test for the European Union of a kind which it has never faced before. They are, if you like, the new awkward squad. And I wouldn't mind betting there are a few sort of Eurocrats around Brussels who will come to look with nostalgia on the difficulty of dealing with Britain as a member once Poland and Hungary really start to force these issues.
Interesting. And James Robbins, finally to you.
I predict a substantial tipping point over the supply of energy throughout certainly the industrialised world and the wider world too. In other words, I think 2018 is going to be decisively the year of renewables and of batteries. The technologies are advancing so fast. We know from 2017 that the national grid has been able to rely increasingly on renewables. I think the tide for fracking is running out. I'm not making a political point here. I just think the cost of extracting hydrocarbons is getting too high given the global price. And so I think in 2018 we will see a significant reverse for those involved in fracking, particularly in the United Kingdom, where it's highly controversial. I think we may see the skids sliding under the whole Hinkley Point C nuclear power station, a complete change of the terms of debate, really, within Britain, and a massive rethink of how we're going to supply ourselves with energy in the future.
You know, it's really interesting sitting here across the studio desk from you, Owen, and thinking, it's a different world. It's through the looking glass somehow. If this was in China, we'd be having a completely different hour-long discussion. There would be no discussion about who's up, who's down, political leaders, etc. It would be all about the economics. Are we going to achieve stable growth in the year ahead? It would be about the Greater Bay Area. Are we going to do that huge infrastructural thing where we put, you know, mighty cities together and build an innovative powerhouse where we're doing artificial intelligence and cutting edge, this, that, and the next thing? It would be about all those kinds of strategic, big, long-term ideas.
That's so,
but it would not be about politics.
It'd be much more inward-looking. If it was this programme in China.
It wouldn't necessarily be inward-looking, but it would look at the issues of the world also in a really different way.
OK, that's a very, very interesting final thought. And thank you very much to you, Carrie Gracie, Kevin Connolly, Ilan Nell, James Robbins and Jim Naughtie. That's it for this year's Correspondents Look Ahead. So, from Owen Bennett-Jones, goodbye.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.